This episode of Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Chiesi is a family-owned, research-focused, sustainable pharmaceutical company accredited with both B Corp and a benefit corporation status. Chiesi is making global changes that benefits patients, providers, and healthcare organizations with forward-looking and impactful initiatives. Chiesi appreciates the integral role that clinical pharmacists play in patient care and are proud to support this community. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Again, that's chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. The Critical Care PRN is dedicated to fostering the role of critical care pharmacists as essential members of the multidisciplinary patient care team. The Critical Care PRN's goal is to optimize drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, including how to become a member, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that website is critprn.accp.com. Welcome to Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast, a partner of the ACCP Critical Care PRN. And I'm your host, Nick Peters. And wherever you are and whoever you are listening, thank you. And we're back with part two in a two-part episode series, glycemic control in the ICU. So part one features Tracy Grues giving more of an overview and history of our management. But today's episode features two pharmacist task members from the 2024 SCCM guidelines on glycemic control for critically ill children and adults. And that is none other than Judy Jacoby and Michael Siri-Matros. So we discuss how they both became involved in the guidelines, differences between the 2012 and 2024 version, which PICO questions were their focus, strongest recommendations, using clinical decision support tools, future research topics on glycemic control in the ICU, plus much, much more. This is an absolute treat. We're all lucky to get to hear the thoughts, advice, and education from these two pharmacy leaders. So sit back and relax, because glycemic control in the ICU part two starts right now.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible, because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And we are joined by two very special guests. Michael Siri-Matros joins us from Houston, Texas, where he is the System Critical Care Pharmacy Services Leader for Houston Methodist Hospital. You find him on a Twitter or X at M. Siri-Matros, his last name. And then the legend Judy Jacoby returns, former SCCM president. She may be retired from the bedside, but is still a master of critical care medicine and a pharmacy icon. I need to be clear, Judy did not give that intro to me. I created that intro just so everyone's on the same page with that. But you can reach out to her on Twitter or X at Judy Jacoby. Michael, Judy, how are you both doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for having us.
Same here. It's good to talk with you again, Nick.
Yeah, it's like I got the Globetrotters on with me. We got people going international, people jumping all around the U.S. It's amazing. So I love that these two panel members, right, if you listen to the intro, specifically vice chair and chair of the 2024 SCCM guidelines on glycemic control in the critically ill So lucky you all joined us. Reminder for the listeners, part one is available now. It features Tracy Grues, where we have more of a discussion into the landmark trials and an overview of glycemic control in the critically ill. But this episode, part two, focusing on the 2024 guidelines with, of course, our two amazing pharmacist panel members. So Judy and Michael, had you worked together or collaborated on a project prior to these guidelines?
Really not. I certainly had met Michael, and you know, as I was involved in leadership, met a lot of people around the country. And luckily for me, when we were starting the task force for these guidelines, probably initially in 2018, I think is when we had our first informal meeting. He got wind of it and volunteered and joined us for this initiative.
Yeah, it's one of those that I don't know that Judy probably remembers me, but I definitely remember her. I was presenting some research during my residency at SCCM Congress, and I was fortunate enough to have Judy as a reviewer of my poster, which was a glucose control-related policy protocol that I was reviewing. So obviously I was honored to have someone at Judy's stature and someone who's related to glucose control focusing on that area, kind of reviewing my poster. And then, you know, 10 years later, asking to join the guideline committee, which I was fortunate at that point to have been a fellow and wanted to really get involved. And I saw that on the docket for the SCCM Congress that year and reached out to her and just said, hey, you know, this is a area of interest of mine. And I was just curious, like, who's allowed to be on the panel. And I would love to join if you'd allow me.
What a cool story of just kind of reaching out to people collaborating. Now you're chair and vice chair. So, you know, Judy and Michael respectively, how close do you all work together compared to the rest of the panel? Do you all have like, I feel like this is the question of like, do you all have a separate group chat from like the bigger group chat of the panel, or how often do you all collaborate?
Yeah, we had two other people involved in our leadership group, as well as our methodologist, Kimia Anur Ahmad. And so really the five of us met often monthly for a period of time over really the probably official four-year work of the task force. It was kind of a slow start, and then we had to wait for SCCM budgeting, and we had COVID in there. But the leadership group every month or two, and then the bigger task force sometimes, that often as well, but often at best quarterly as this stretched on.
So, you know, a lot of what we're going to be talking about is the 2024 guidelines, but we're going to be referencing the 2012 guidelines. And for those maybe less familiar, referring to the document Guidelines for the Use of an Insulin Infusion for the Management of Hyperglycemia in Critically Ill Patients. So, Judy, were there any other panel members such as yourself who were both on the 2012 and 2024 version of these guidelines?
Actually, we were able to repurpose and tap into that expertise of many of the people who were originally authors on that first guideline. My co-chair, Nick Bircher, Jamie Crinsley, Michael Agus, Susan Braithwaite, who's an endocrinologist, who, when she joined the second time, admitted to some health issues, and sadly she died while we were working on the 2024. Amado Friere, Karen Sands, and Guillermo Umperez were all carried over from the original guideline.
So it sounds like a really good mix of people who kind of understand some of the historical perspective, right? Some of those names, right? They're famous names from some of those trials that we're all familiar with, mm-hmm. but then also getting new perspective from all sorts of disciplines getting added on. Cause it looks like it's still multidisciplinary, like the first guidelines were, which feels like that's kind of unique at the time compared to a lot of others, you know, 2012.
SCCM certainly has codified their standard operating procedures, but really, since I joined SCCM in the early 80s, it gave me incredible opportunities to be on a lot of task forces because they've always been so adamant about having a multi-professional group. Now, obviously, we have a whole bunch more pharmacists to choose from than in those early days, but it's really an imperative. And we lost some nurses along the way, and so that was probably one of the biggest challenges in terms of maintaining our multi-professional group.
When you dig into the text, one thing that I noticed, right, is that there are patient and family advocates on the panel. And kind of the language says they, quote unquote, participated when asked by a co-chair. So describe to us kind of when were they asked to participate and what kind of unique perspective did they provide? Because I'm sure they're thinking about things that are nowhere in the radar of you all, the experts, as you're going through this stuff.
Yeah, early on, there was a discussion of adding patient or family advocates to the committee, and it was a unique perspective for myself to think about that. And I think obviously most of us would agree with needing to get an outside perspective, just like we do at the IRB level. You want people that are, outside thought and making sure that you're not just thinking in one bubble. And so they were actually part of most of our conversations and most of our meetings that we had, especially were asked to speak up related to items that we thought that really pertained to the patient's focus and what we wanted the committee to make sure that we really thought about the patient and what the patient would want out of it. And a lot of our tasks that we were looking at and outcomes really were looked at in light of what the patient would want. And in this case, being an ICU patient, it's hard to get a patient who remembers what happens to them when they're in the ICU. So we were very fortunate to have two individuals who were patient advocates or family members of individuals who were there every day while their family member was in the ICU and really remember those kinds of items that they remembered related to glucose control, or maybe had had some experience with glucose control in the past. And so they had a little bit more insight than maybe a regular patient or a family advocate.
That's so cool, getting the perspective of those, because I didn't even realize, I think any patient or family member could have a perspective, but those who literally went through a critical illness are these patients that we're talking about. What a cool perspective and participation on that panel. Yeah, you're right. That's absolutely awesome.
Oh, and I'm going to give a shout out to John Devlin, who really, I think, codified and spearheaded that effort with the PADIS guidelines, where they obviously the patient can have a very, very important perspective on analgesia and use of sedatives. So we'll give him a shout out on that one.
Yeah, we stand John Devlin on this podcast 100%. So anytime you can get a reference to him in, and yeah, a little preview, he's going to be coming on in about a month. So that'll be awesome. But when looking at the scope of these guidelines, and it's highlighted in the supplemental content, what was the role of outcome prioritization as you look at what you're going to, ultimately cover essentially in these guidelines?
Yeah, so when we looked at outcomes, we actually let all the panel members come up with a list of what they thought was important related to glucose control. And then once we got that full list, we then sent that out for everyone to rank in order of importance. And the unique thing to this is that it was ranked in order of importance of what you think a patient or family member would want from those outcomes, which I thought was also very interesting. While we always think about what we want out of outcomes and what we think is important, I think putting that spin on what a patient's family or a family member would want may adjust a little bit of what you kind of, ranked in terms of high or low. And that then led us to then decide kind of as we went throughout to put focus in on the areas that we really thought was the most important, and then maybe focus a little less on the areas that were of least importance as we kept going through. And obviously this guideline lasted for several years, so it was always important to go back to the fundamentals of what do patients want, what do families want, and where should we be putting our focus in this guideline.
And then what we had to do is look at the various trials we were including and assess whether they actually measured our outcomes of interest. But we started with that being predefined. In addition, we had to define our glucose buckets in terms of what comparators we wanted. And again, that was a predefined decision. And then we looked at the literature. Obviously, we kind of knew what was out there, but looked to see which literature would fit what we had determined a priori.
And I love that you mentioned what perspective it is, because if you look at that supplemental digital content four, you'll notice in the bottom, like one of the lowest three is achieving, maintaining desired glycemic control, right? Where I think if you pull everyone else, it'd probably be a little higher. So that perspective is, or understanding that perspective, I think is really important. So how many questions did the 2012 guidelines have? Kind of thinking historically, what was your all's kind of scope in that document?
You know, we really didn't have any rules in those days. And so it honestly ended up, again, it was a multi-year project, much more of a review with some meta-analysis. But overall, we attempted to answer 18 questions and for adults and pediatrics. So a much broader scope. It was all volunteer. We didn't have a budget. We didn't have any real limits. And it did give us the opportunity to address a variety of topics that honestly probably still to this day don't have adequate literature, but to make some suggestions based upon what we found at that time. Since you know, the 2024, we were budgeted and had a limit on the number of questions we could ask. A lot of that content from 2012, I think, still has validity, at least as a starting point for discussion as to how we should be managing those other topics.
Which one, if you had to highlight a couple things that you think are still very important from that 2012 version, what would some of those be?
So I think probably the biggest ones that we reviewed quite extensively were whatever literature was available on acute hypoglycemia treatment in the hospital setting, really separating that out from EMS, emergency medicine response, sources of blood, in terms of a vascular source, arterial or venous, being more reliable than a finger stick, and kind of getting into all the challenges associated with finger stick testing. A bit on the limits of meters. Some of that might be outdated as technology's improved and some of the drug interaction effects have been mitigated to a great extent. But I think an overall focus on insulin safety, you know, and there's pharmacists certainly are very familiar with it as a high-risk drug. And we also were able to touch on transitions of care, nutrition, and some of the metrics that had been proposed up to that point that, again, we just never got to in this latest guideline.
So 2012, 18 questions. I love that you referred to as the wild, you know, the wild times, like it's the Wild West, like 30 years ago or something, very, very recent. But what about the 2024 guidelines? How does that does that compare in terms of like questions and scope?
Yeah, so we were limited partially in the number of questions we can ask, and so we had to be very thoughtful in which questions that we wanted to go for with PICO questions. Obviously, the guideline style has changed. We use GRADE now as kind of the standard that SCCM uses. And with that, then you're allowed kind of so many questions. There's also a certain budget that we had to fall within. And then with this new guideline, we also added pediatrics. And so whatever question that we had on the adult side, more or less, we also asked the exact same question on the pediatric side, which is its own PICO question and was kind of eating into our PICO budget. So we kind of really focused in on six main topics on the adult and pediatric side, primarily looking at areas that we thought that there was enough literature to be able to do a new analysis on, and that would actually get us something of function that we'd be able to actually hope to answer, and left the questions that we thought were still valid and hadn't really changed to just being in the 2012 guideline. So the updated questions that we asked for the 2024 guideline was really the trigger target for insulin initiation. So what blood glucose should you start insulin therapy in? Also the ongoing question of what ranges should you be targeting, and we kind of had to choose two ranges. The way GRADE works, you kind of have to pick a range versus kind of say what range is the best. We had to kind of come up with a range in the beginning, and that was an area we had a lot of discussions about and controversy in the beginning as well. We also had a question related to continuous IV infusion versus intermittent sub-Q insulin therapy. Look at the frequency of blood glucose monitoring, as that's obviously an area of interest not only for patients and patient satisfaction, but also on the quality side for nursing, and they're the ones that have to actually do this. So what's considered feasible and also leads to important outcomes. And then the use of explicit clinical decision support tools, as that is an area that we recognize that you have a lot of differences in outcomes in different trials, and it could be related to goals, it could be related to lots of factors, but one of the factors that we think has a big component in that is whether or not they're using quality protocols or quality decision support tools. Then finally, meters has been a topic for a long, long time, and so we were hoping there'd be more information on meters, and the ability to have quality meters and what's the best meters to use. But we didn't really want to get into like brand names and things like that, but just to see what data was out there on monitoring using different types of meters. So those were kind of the focuses for the new update.
And let me tell you that the work on the wording of the PICO question sometimes took more than one meeting to re and for anybody who knows GRADE, the semantics are so key in terms of how things are worded. We wanted it to be relevant to a clinician, but really be able to reflect the science appropriately as well.
And if you're looking at those PICO questions, remember we have Judy to thank for the fact that the milligrams per deciliter is listed in parentheses, because you got to use the international standard units. Because I griped with her, right, of the millimoles per liter, and she made it known that she's part of the reason that we even got them in parentheses at all. Now, it's March Madness time, so thinking with that mindset, what was the first one out? What was maybe the honorable mention PICO question, or the one that just didn't make the cut, or you maybe wish you could have got in there if things were a little different?
Oh, and I meant to go back and look and see what was next on the list of things. I think probably given our opportunity to have more PICO questions, we probably would have gotten into greater depth than we were able to on continuous glucose monitoring. And we've touched on it just a little, but I think we would have probably dealt with it as its own question, given the latitude.
Thinking about notable or important changes from the 2012 to 2024 guidelines, what would you all, as you kind of look and compare, what would you say is maybe one of the biggest changes that you each kind of want to highlight?
Probably the biggest one is that in the 2012 guideline, we included observational studies as well as randomized controlled trials in our meta-analysis. And so and the data just weren't as robust at that time, and that was the reason we did that. And so that gave the slightest little suggestion that intensive insulin therapy might be associated with lower mortality. But much like the current guideline, there was no question that it was also associated with hypoglycemia. And when we came to the 2024 guideline, because of the amount of randomized controlled trial data that was available, specifically for Pico 2 in terms of the target, we decided to only include randomized control trials and not a retrospective or observational trial. Boy, we grappled with that for a long time because there is, we think, some quality observational data available. But the concern would be that if there's a contradiction between the two, what do you pick? And again, we were a little bit budget limited, and so we didn't go and do a meta-analysis to include the observational data. But honestly, oh gosh, Michael, can you guess how many hours we spent on that very topic? It was a lot.
I mean, I definitely think it was the most controversial, and we spent a lot of time in debates, in meetings, outside of meetings, describing what to do with that. And I do think we made the right decision. I think it came back again, just like Judy said, is that if you have randomized controlled trials and observational trials, we are kind of taught that randomized trials are what you follow. And in this case, we had quite a few randomized trials. Even though the data didn't exactly match between observational and randomized, if we had included the observational, it would have left us and the reader, it would have left them confused because, we know that by default, the randomized trials are kind of higher on the pyramid. And so that's where we decided to land on. But we do make comments to the observational trials and use that as a focus of research in the future, that we think that we really need more research in randomized controlled trials in some of those controversial areas where primarily the positive data comes from observational trials. And I think that's probably the best thing that we can do from the guideline is give researchers out there a topic to go after and to hopefully add to the literature so that we can try to include this in a future revision. In terms of one area that I thought was probably one of the more important changes or maybe the more surprising changes is, again, going to that PICO 2 question and what ranges we chose. I know that there was a lot of debate on that. And also when we described our results at the SECM Congress, there was a little question related to, why did you choose this and how did you choose this, cutoff? So I do think that the cutoffs that we use, which was, 80 to 139 as the lower end targets, may have been kind of a surprise for some people, as very few people use tight glycemic control targets anymore. But we needed to include the encompassment of kind of all the literature that's out there, which a lot of the historic literature used a lot of tight glycemic control lower ranges, even though we don't currently use a lot of those lower ranges anymore. And then I think even on the upper end, the 140 to 200 was probably a little bit of a surprise for some people. And again, we had to think about where the trial data and what they used as their cutoffs to then say we need to be more encompassing of what the trial literature showed so that we're not excluding some very key research publications if we had chosen maybe a more typical range like a 140 to 180, which I think more people are familiar with.
And part of that was to make sure that we could include what we felt were important clinical trials. Even though it may or may not match exactly what people are using in practice. But truth be told, comes out probably close enough to other published guidelines as to be relatively minor in the big picture. Probably one of the other big changes from 2012 is that for 2012, we couldn't say much about pediatrics at all. There really wasn't much data that was very robust. And again, we had the researchers on this guideline, Michael Agus, Ellie Hirschberg, Michael Lanspa, brilliant contributions to the literature, in some cases, both adult and pediatrics, but certainly for pediatrics. And so it allowed us to give a strong recommendation against the use of tight glycemic control for pediatrics, in part because despite using continuous glucose monitoring to mitigate risks, they still had an undesirable rate rate of hypoglycemia, and pretty clear there was no difference in outcome. And so I think that's something else to really point out, is that in many ways the pediatric literature is more robust than the adult.
That's the strongest recommendation in the whole in the whole document. That's the strong recommendation both in adults and pediatrics. And you mentioned large randomized controlled trials. So in like late September, right, TGC FAST was released. So how did this affect the guidelines? Did anything change? I'm guessing the emails were getting spread rapidly when that thing got published. What effect did that have on the guidelines themselves?
We knew it was coming because Jean-Charles Prise, you know, was part of the European group and he had a little more inside information, although he wasn't an investigator. So, you know, we kept pumping him for information all along. But we still were surprised a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, this guideline process took quite a long time. I think it was for all of us, it was a little longer than maybe we had initially thought it was going to be. And at some point we had to kind of pull the trigger on saying, like, do we keep waiting or not? So we knew it was there. We knew that they were kind of in the final stages, but we were also to a point that we, as part of the submission, you have to have completed your last review of the literature within a certain time frame. I want to say it was within 6 months or 9 months of when you submitted. And we had already done that once, if not twice, did like a go back and look at the last, because so much time had passed, we had to keep doing that. And so we kind of made it a decision that because we didn't know exactly when it was going to get published, and if that literature did come out in time, it probably would get us past the window and we'd have to redo all the analysis again. We decided to go ahead and submit because we were ready to do so. And then in the time frame that we then did submit, we were able to get the information from, you know, the preliminary information from the TGC FAST trial. And then we did incorporate some of the concepts into the writing of the document, although it wasn't included in the systematic review part, because that would have made us have to go back and do systematic review for the whole thing all over again. But we did include, how their outcomes, we think, compare to what we did and showed in the guidelines. And we don't feel that any of the changes and anything that came from TGC FAST would have dramatically changed the recommendation that we had in terms of what the recommendation said. It possibly could change, you know, some of the level of certainty or things like that. But in terms of what they showed and what our systematic review showed, were quite similar.
So as you kind of go and you look at the like text or like the recommendations from 2012 to 2024, one of the other things that kind of stands out is the 2012 document has a lot of discussion into specific patient populations, right? Like post-cardiac surgery, some of the neurocritical care patients like ischemic stroke, IPH, things like that. So why is there less discussion of those specific patient populations in this newest version?
Probably one of the biggest reasons is that a fair amount of that data was observational studies rather than randomized controlled trials. And so kind of by virtue of that, they weren't as extensively included. So again, we had identified the outcomes we were going to analyze. We knew we wanted randomized controlled trials. And so then it's really a matter of looking at the studies that we were including to see if they had measured those outcomes or not. We didn't find a lot of significant differences, especially for the higher level outcomes.
Yeah, and we did try to pull, you know, all those other types of subpopulations, trauma and cardiac and surgery, and where we could do a meta-analysis, we did, and we included that in several of the sections for sure. Mm-hmm. But most of them didn't have enough data or randomized trials to be able to actually include them into something that would be purposeful. So that's why we decided not to include them in the paper or in the discussion so much.
So as we move a lot to grade methodology for these guidelines, right, one of the things you kind of start to realize is there's going to be some questions that are kind of unanswerable from like our high level grade methodology. So as you were going through this, were there questions or maybe assumptions that we have that we're not necessarily going to be able to get this high quality level 1A evidence for or against?
Well, I would say the meters were her biggest frustration. And in part, because if you're comparing one device or using one device, such as a meter or a continuous glucose monitor or whatever, and comparing it to what you deem as a gold standard, is there enough consistency in the methodology relative to patient outcomes to say one system or device is better than the other? And so most of them had surrogate endpoints of, you know, an acceptable value in an error grid as a totally surrogate endpoint and not a necessarily a patient. Some of them would be patient meaningful if they're in the high risk categories. But so that type of comparison really wasn't conducive to doing a PICO question and answer. And, you know, there's a gazillion meters, there's many, many gold standards, depends on who's, you know, is this a goal, is your gold standard something physically in the lab run completely by your med techs in the lab? Is this a device like a blood gas machine that's maybe in your ICU, but still run by your ICU staff? And so there's just so many variables that try as we might, we couldn't squeeze that one into a PICO format.
So the guidelines suggest using a continuous IV insulin infusion to treat hyperglycemia, but obviously, every patient that goes in the ICU can't get a continuous IV insulin infusion. Can't think of anything that would make you public enemy number one more than that. So are there specific patients or patient populations where sub-Q insulin might actually be our preferential, you know, first line insulin administration kind of technique?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously the guideline isn't necessarily trying to say that every patient needs to be on an an insulin drip. And we don't want to make, you know, enemies of our nursing colleagues that have to manage these patients. You know, I think most of us would agree that sub-Q insulin, you know, correction scales, basal bolus is probably the appropriate route for initiation of therapy in some patients, especially in patients that don't have, you know, severely high hyperglycemia, patients that seem to have response to, you know, relatively small doses of sub-Q insulin. However, those patients that once you recognize that you're not getting them in control despite making appropriate adjustments, patients that tend to be labile or have, you know, episodes of hypoglycemia because you're maybe not able to estimate the changes that happen in the patient, whether it be, you know, changes in nutrition, changes in glucose that they're getting, patients that are having, you know, episodes of sepsis or whatever that makes them kind of unreliable, and you know that you probably need more short-term and more frequent monitoring and dosing changes. And those are probably the patients that we really recommend that switching over to, you know, continuous insulin infusion. Obviously for centers also that have bed capacity issues in which, you know, sending them to an ICU isn't possible. And you know, you might have a policy or a procedure in a hospital in which you can only use a drip in the ICU or maybe a step down unit, then those I think are appropriate patients to try to get them in control. But control means trying to give them moderately aggressive doses that, you know, of sub-Q insulin instead of just giving them these baby, you know, very conservative doses, because you're just not going to cut it with giving someone, you know, 1 to 2 units of insulin in a patient who maybe has diabetes or has, you know, some kind of steroids on board. You really need to have something of a little bit more substance in those situations. So,
Well, and even in the early days when we were really pretty adamant about tight glycemic control and use of an insulin infusion, clearly the workload issues are an overriding concern. And so Jamie Crinsley, who was part of our author panel and both sets of guidelines, I give him full credit still for his 2006 paper where they described the use of rapid acting insulin, Novolog, Humalog type, insulins with every 3 hour glucose monitoring. So, you know, you've cut down the frequency of monitoring and as Michael said, you just set some limits as to how many, you know, outside of whatever your goal range is that you're going to allow before you look at either adding long acting insulin or switching to in continuous infusion. You know, that's still that determined how we practiced for many years, and with every 3 to 4 hour rapid acting insulin, and you can get a lot of patients through. The other piece of it now, if you do look at the Gunst paper in the New England Journal of Medicine this past fall, the TGC FAST, for their high target group, only about half the patients actually were on insulin. And so it's going to be a major workload factor as to how you set your targets as well.
So do the 2024 guidelines, do they emphasize hypoglycemia less? Or because when you look at the 2012, it feels like there's 3, 4, even 5 pages devoted to it. How does the 2024 version kind of address it?
Not a lot, honestly, other than probably our biggest emphasis was on a protocol that is well demonstrated to have a low risk of hypoglycemia, putting the onus really on your diabetes quality assurance teams, which I think everyone should have, to really know your local data. And I'll let Michael speak to that because that's been such a big focus for his group. So we didn't get into treatment specifically. Our focus really was on prevention. And so some of that comes down to frequency of blood glucose monitoring as well. Continuing to emphasize intervals while you're acutely titrating of no more than an hour in an unstable patient, so that at least if there is hypoglycemia, you either mitigate it sooner or identify it sooner.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example between the 2012 and 2024, as we felt that the information from the 2012 guidelines related to hypoglycemia was still pertinent. We didn't really need to overly go over more information related to hypoglycemia because I think we all feel that that's still an area of greatest concern when it comes to these protocols, and the risk of hypoglycemia is one of the areas that needs to be continued to focus, as that's, even if you look at some of the major trials, some of the outcomes that they see, how much is it related to the targets that they look at that versus their rates of hypoglycemia that they saw. And it's hard to kind of pull out those differences between, you know, one protocol to or one study to another. But yeah, we didn't really focus too much on that area just because we felt like that has kind of already been stated and hasn't really changed much in the past, you know, decade or so.
But I will emphasize the fact that it needs to be established that nurses can rescue first, you know, get dextrose into the patient. Then if you feel it's appropriate to repeat the blood glucose, do it then to make sure you don't have continued hypoglycemia, and that it be some sort of protocolized process. It should never be something that you need a specific provider order for.
Yeah, it felt like, you know, I was kind of looking at it, it felt like you addressed it throughout all the different PICO questions rather than having it just a true dedicated, like, big question like in the previous ones. It felt like a lot of those were pieced in, and it makes sense when you have to reduce the amount of questions you're looking at that drastically that you'll address others throughout them, right, as ways to kind of pepper in some things. So, but I like that explanation as to kind of the, when you went into it, some of the methodologic, kind of the differences in thinking from that perspective. Personalized medicine, one of the things with that is the use of the clinical decision support tools. And I think insulin kind of right behind pharmacokinetic dosing are probably two of the areas where this is being used more on the forefront, kind of more frequently. And I think when you use these tools, you have to have specific things in place to help ensure safety and efficacy of this new intervention, right? It's education and training and things. So table 5 of these guidelines is incredible. Using that as a guide highlights some of those important considerations if there's someone listening trying to implement these CDS practices.
You know, this is definitely an area where we felt that we really needed to give, readers and practitioners an area to really focus in on. Obviously, everyone does glucose control in a different way, but because there's so many different ways of doing it, even at the same institution, you might have different ways in different units. That's why we see a dramatic difference in outcomes, whether it be hypoglycemia or getting within range or, you know, quality metrics related to mortality, et cetera, length of stay. And so in order to really try to hone in on what we felt was important in protocols, we decided to really to list out explicitly 5 different criteria that we thought we should be looking at for what's considered a true explicit decision support tool. And so the first one was it had to have explicit recommendations in which the clinician knows exactly what to do. So there's no question of like, what, you know, in this situation, do I do this or this? It tells them exactly what to do in every scenario. Secondly, need to be reproducible actions. And so the same patient in the same situation would get the exact same kind of therapy. Third, needed to have at least 2 inputs, patient-specific inputs for variables. So those inputs could be the blood glucose level itself. Maybe it could be a change or a rate of change in blood glucose. It could be something related to if they had an episode of hypoglycemia, what might change in the protocol. It could be something related to nutrition or nutritional changes. But it needs to include at least 2 pieces of information that were patient-specific in order to be considered an explicit decision support tool. At the same time, also need to have 2 output points. And so those could be related to what the change in the dose would be, what the timing of the next blood sugar would be, if it's 30 minutes later, an hour later, 2 hours later, but there need to be at least 2 output points. And then finally, it needed to be an open loop system. And there really aren't really any closed loop systems really in the United States. There are some in other countries and that, you know, we might have been kind of talking about there. But really the important piece here was to be able to make sure that a clinician had to agree or disagree with the recommendation, that it wasn't just something that kind of lives on its own and just kind of just goes. We wanted to make sure that someone could make a clinical decision. And if something didn't seem right, then they reached out to a provider to then make a change in the protocol. And we think that all those pieces are really essential into having a high-level protocol or decision support tool that should be used in practice and then should be studied to determine that they're getting the outcomes that they're expecting.
Obviously, a lot of these are going to be best run with some sort of computerized protocol and not just taking a table and putting it on a computer for the clinician to read, but that the computer is specifically saying, if this, do that. We did a home-built system that's still running in my old institution. If it goes down, it'll be bad because nobody knows that computer language anymore. There are commercial products available. The big systems are building in insulin titration processes. Epic has I'm sure it's something you have to purchase. All the, you know, big companies, you know, have it for a price. And especially if you say, you know what, you know, we're using less and less continuous infusion insulin. Our nurses are stressed, they're overworked, and so their expertise is going to lag a bit as well. And for most ICUs, the best example I can say is ask a nurse to titrate nitroprusside or even nitroglycerin if you're outside of a cardiac ICU, right? It's if they don't do it very often, they really don't know what how best to accomplish that. And I think insulin being a high risk drug kind of falls in the same category, that the more support we can provide, the more structure, the safer it's going to be when we do use those infusions.
So thinking about safety, how realistic is it, or what would you say to someone who says it's not realistic to have these CDS programs at a more rural or community hospital compared to, you know, academic medical centers, the teaching hospitals?
I think, you know, it depends on the level. And so, you know, is it feasible to have something that costs a lot of money and it takes a lot of technology? And if you don't have individuals that can run all, you know, the complicatedness that is related to a brand new protocol, I get that. I think the big takeaway here, though, is that you don't have to reinvent the wheel with this. There are published protocols. People know people at other centers. They can borrow a protocol that has been validated and use those. So I think implementation of something that's been created shouldn't be that complicated. And I do think that non-academic centers or community hospitals or small hospitals still have the ability to be able to implement these types of protocols, because in the end, if you're not implementing a protocol like this, then how is your glucose control going? And so having no answer is not an answer. And two, if you're creating your own that doesn't contain these types of pieces that the whole panel felt were essential to being a high level protocol, then are you doing your patients a disservice, because then you're providing potentially care that is not high quality and or has poor outcomes. And I think we all know that there's many protocols, even in some large landmark trials, that were not quality, and it showed based on the rates of hypoglycemia. And so we, I think, really know from those big trials that it's just as important having what the goals and ranges that you're looking at, as well as having the quality protocol to go with it. And if you don't have both, then you're really not doing, you're not trying to achieve, you know, the end target, which is to have better outcomes, lower hypoglycemia, et cetera.
And not part of the guidelines, certainly, but I think the days of each ICU within an individual hospital having their own protocol ought to be gone. They ought to all be using the same targets and the same general structure. And the, again, the more you streamline, then it'll be easier for your quality assurance committees to get a handle on that.
I just have an ask for anybody, because the listservs are a great source for this, right? And you'll see it. My only ask, if you come in and ask for one of these protocols, please do not say, I don't want to reinvent the wheel. We all know it. You don't have to say it in the message itself. That's my only PSA here. Now, you mentioned that the guidelines are for adult and pediatric patients. So what role did the adult specialist, aka YouTube, for example, have with voting on pediatric recommendations, and then vice versa? You know, did they kind of contribute to yours? How did that process go, having those two different kind of specialties?
Well, I think knowing my weakness in pediatrics, I haven't even cross-covered peds on a weekend forever and ever. You know, I was able as one of the leads to go and specifically focus and review that literature in depth. But we truly, truly relied on our pediatric experts to lead the way. And when it came to actually doing the final vote on the pediatric statements, many of our adult committee members abstained because they didn't feel like they had the expertise in that specialty area. But in the contrast, so many of our pediatric people, Ellie Hirschberg, Elizabeth Farrington, most notably, have live in both worlds. They do both adults and peds. And so they were able to help us bridge some of those differences, I think, more effectively because of that as well.
I think a lot of it too, when it came down to discussion, especially in the beginning, you know, the peds group could have picked a different PICO question, a different target, but most almost everything kind of said you know, what we're doing in the adult world, we think is the exact same kind of question that we should look at in the pediatric world. And so I think if anything that helped align a little bit between the peds and the adult world is that we were looking at the exact kind of question, just a different population, and what did the outcome show? There might have been a few areas where people that only do adults felt uncomfortable, like interjecting or like giving an opinion on. But, you know, in the end, the data is the data. The force plot is the force plot. And, you know, an adult practitioner can look at that same force plot and vote on, you know, whether this answers a question or not. And so I think most people felt comfortable with most items, but there might have been a few in which they were like, this is really outside of my scope. And then they were allowed to abstain on those.
This episode of Pharmacy to Dose is proudly sponsored by Chiesi. Providing innovative pharmacologic therapies for over 85 years, Chiesi is committed to supporting the clinical pharmacist community and the patients you serve. To learn more, visit chiesi.pharmacytodose.com. Any other notable highlights or things from a pediatric recommendation standpoint?
So probably the biggest thing was their use of good practice statements and again, even semantics. I've suggested to SCCM that they pick a term because some guidelines are using best practice. We chose to use good practice, but honestly went back and forth. Best practice kind of has a connotation, I think, that's a little bit more prescriptive. With our good practice statements, it was to provide some guidance to the clinician based upon the expertise of our writing panel, which, you know, doesn't get any better than who we had, and to give certainly some direction for clinicians. And so we actually did, I think, a little bit more of that in peds than we did for adults as well. But I think that's important to be aware of. But truly, in lieu of anything better, a good practice statement means probably it's pretty similar to a strong recommendation. And then we also had some in our practice statements. So again, semantic differences, that, you know, kind of here's what we generally do, but, we just, you know, can't advise beyond what, you know, is our current state. And we did a little bit of that for adults too, just, since I mostly mentioned peds.
So table four in the guidelines is really great. And I highlight seven research priority topics in this population. So in your all's opinion, because a lot of this will be opinion based on what you may think is the most important research topic, but what's maybe one that could influence guideline recommendations or one of these topics that stands out from each of your perspectives?
Yeah, I would say for me, the topic that I really wish we could have tackled is the kind of the personalized medicine between, you know, different populations like diabetics and non-diabetics. You know, in terms of data in the last decade, there's been some great, you know, studies and put out, especially by Dr. Crinsley, related to patients with diabetes and non-diabetes, and those, you know, observational trials, like looking at, you know, the J-shaped curve that you kind of see with mortality, specifically in diabetic patients. So, you know, I don't know how many people that don't follow the glucose control literature are aware of that. And so I think that's an area that if we had some randomized controlled trials that came out, it would be an area that we definitely would want to tackle in a guideline to be able to include, you know, what has been seen as, I don't know if you want to call it trends or whatever the case might be, but the positive data and showing that, you know, maybe you don't want to target lower blood glucose levels in diabetic patients, but maybe it doesn't have a factor in non-diabetic patients. And we really start treating patients individually. And I think there's a lot more individualized medicine that we're seeing, you know, on the outpatient side. And I think we can even see that on the inpatient side. We try to put patients in buckets of, you know, oh, they're surgical, they're medical, and we try to give different targets. But I think it goes beyond that. And I think his studies and others that have studied in that area have really started to find a very unique population in which we might need to be treating patients a little bit differently beyond just what unit do you physically sit in, as that obviously doesn't make sense because you can have a surgical patient in a medical ICU or vice versa. So
Yeah, I think that and it may incorporate a variety of different metrics. Look, you know, maybe based on glycosylated hemoglobin and relative to chronic blood sugars, and to come up with some sort of ratio to set your targets based on that. The data are observational in that area, but pretty compelling. So I think certainly warrants additional research. And I think just in general, other metrics of glycemic control still are, well, we still lack a gold standard. And I can't even tell you, for example, what is an acceptable hypoglycemia rate. You know, certainly our early clinical trials had rates as high as 15%, and you know, clearly unacceptable. The most recent trial had very low rates of severe hypoglycemia, and with a very sophisticated computerized protocol and a well-trained staff. So, you know, so the truth lies somewhere in between. And I really think we need to set a metric that becomes something that sites can compare themselves with. Certainly in the US, the CMS targets at least measuring hypoglycemia in general, I think are going to help us kind of hone in a little bit on what's going on hospital-wide, and maybe it'll generate some data for hospitals to look specifically at their insulin infusion patients if that's their primary population who ends up getting measured as a CMS hypoglycemic event.
I think another area that, you know, we just unfortunately don't have opportunity too much in the U.S., but, you know, the continuous glucose monitors, I think that's an area that we all are, you know, biting at the tip to try to see if we could get that into practice. And if we could, it would dramatically change, I think, the way the guidelines are written, how we practice. Unfortunately, you know, we just haven't had any companies that have been able to get past that line of getting something approved and something that people would actually use that don't have a lot of negative factors in how you get that glucose, or, you know, is it, you know, you have to use heparin or whatever with it. And so because of that, we haven't really been able to get past that that range. We do everything else continuous. Blood pressure, temperature, everything is continuous, except for we still, you know, take a needle and pick a, you know, poke a finger, you know, multiple times a day. And so it's a little archaic, but I think if we were able to get across that line, we would definitely have some really unique, you know, personalized medicine and potentially actually really improved outcomes if we can actually get continuous glucose monitoring.
And safety in particular. And you know, I guess that's the one place we can say, yay, COVID helped us liberalize the use of sub-Q continuous glucose monitors. And so, you know, I think Michael is referring more to the intravascular types of truly continuous or near continuous measurement devices. Certainly there may be a role for the sub-Q devices in select patients, but there are enough patients who, despite our best efforts, still are not great candidates for sub-Q monitoring. And even if they are used in a limited basis, you still need to double check those values in some manner. So it's progressed, but it's still not entirely ready for prime time. Not going to make it to the round of 16.
Not a Sweet 16 team. That's exactly right. I want to shift gears here a second, and we've been talking a lot about the clinical content within the guidelines and thinking about glycemic control. But when we're lucky enough to hear from two people, and especially the two pharmacists involved in the whole guideline process, we gotta talk and dive into a little bit of that. So from your all's perspective, because I think you'll both probably have different perspectives, what do pharmacists need to do or continue doing to keep being involved on these multidisciplinary guideline panels?
I guess for me, when I first asked to join on this guideline, I came from an area of thinking, am I qualified? You know, I haven't been in practice for, you know, decades, or I'm not necessarily well known in this area. And so I put a lot of doubt in myself, but at the same time, I knew it was an area that I was very passionate about. It was an area which I had done lots of quality studies, lots of posters, lots of presentations. And I felt like I had done a little bit of my homework on this, but it's, you have a little bit of that kind of imposter syndrome, like, I don't know, like, you know, that I should be allowed to be on the guideline, or if someone's going to look at me saying, like, why is this guy there? And so I think the only thing I would say is you need to put yourself out there. You should feel like, you know, hey, as long as you have done the work, as long as you are, you know, versed in the area, and whether published on it, presented on it, doesn't hurt to reach out to whoever's, you know, leading a panel or a guideline and just say, hey, like, I'm interested. Hey, this is what I'm willing to do, or this is what I'm interested in helping with. Could you use someone like me? And I think a lot of individuals at the time, you know, that was me 7 years ago, but I think a lot more individuals probably would step up if they felt that, you know, you didn't need to be the, you know, Gigi Jacobi's of the world, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, like, there's only a handful of people that kind of get to that level. And in order to be able to, you know, put your foot out there, you really have to advocate for yourself, I think, at some times, and be willing to put in the work. And I think that's another big area that, you know, for individuals, it's not about just being part of the group. You have to be willing to do your part in the group. And I think that's kind of what sets an individual apart. And obviously pharmacists are individuals that can definitely set themselves apart by being used to doing a lot of the work, whether it be at committee levels, et cetera. This is also something that has shown in guidelines as well.
Oh yeah. Pharmacists are good at organizing, and you give us a deadline and certainly we're going to get it done as close to that deadline as possible. SCCM has done outstanding work in terms of developing a standard operating procedure for guidelines. They've opened up the process to even submit an idea for a guideline. The form asks for lots of information, like who would you include, and kind of asking for a little bit of structure to begin with. So, you know, for an individual to go in and say, I think I'll write a guideline, it's pretty intimidating from the onset. And as we've taken away business meetings from the Congress, I think it's much more opaque to know what's even in process. And so I think that's an opportunity that the next phase for the college to make that, you know, a call for, and it's, I know it's a double-edged sword to do a call for volunteers. You're liable to get a lot of people, but I think that's a real opportunity for them to not have the same old people all the time and to really find some of that untapped expertise to be involved in writing a guideline. And so it's really a matter of the chairs and co-chairs to put on their multidisciplinary, multi-professional hat and say, all right, who's published in this area? Last time I had an opportunity to suggest people for a guideline, that's what I did. Who's published in the area? And for us, perhaps more seasoned people to pay it forward and really help advocate for the folks who are doing the work now.
In defense of that, it can be hard. As someone who, I'm always trying to find people to talk about specific topics and things, you know, if you're not necessarily out there with your expertise, how is anyone going to know? So that's a, I like both of those different perspectives. Now, one of the other things through kind of talking with others on these panels is that manuscript writing is different than other peer-reviewed publication writing. So what's a tip or something that you learned kind of related specifically to the writing of like a guideline manuscript?
Probably the biggest thing was you have to be really well-versed in the standard operating procedures. And so going into the guideline, we started knowing we had a 3,000 word limit as our starting point. And you know, even to the, you know, the abstract has a very specific word number for each section. And so when you start to allocate it out for each PICO, you're down to a very small number of words per section. And yet you have to still present the data. And even that format is outlined for you in terms of how you are to present that data. And so that the amount that you actually have, so you've got your evidence and your meta-analysis result and evidence to recommendation, where you get a chance to at least have a little bit of discussion about it. And then your research topic section. It's very challenging to cram all that information into one piece. And so you're not going to get a big narrative review like we did in 2012, because that latitude's just not there.
I think for me, you know, I was brand new to this process. I told Judy from the get-go, I don't know anything about writing a guideline, but I would love to learn from you. So she was great to learn under. And if anything, I would say the tip would be to have like a Judy or someone who's been part of the process before to really kind of guide the process, because it can be very overwhelming. Even just in the beginning, learning the grade process, I found that to be extremely overwhelming. We had many sessions to learn about how grade mm-hmm. works and what it means and the process. And so I think having, you know, someone who has been through the process before is essential to keeping the process going and to making it kind of smooth for everybody. I think the other kind of takeaway that I had is, you know, making sure that you're just persistent in reading by section. It can get old to even us, because at some point you've read the same thing over and over again. And so sometimes you got to just like sit down and say, I'm just got to focus on this one section mm-hmm. and I'm going to read it. I'm going to read it again. I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to come back to the third section on a different day, because otherwise it starts all kind of just blending in mm-hmm. and you're not actually picking up the pieces that you need to be picking up. Because I think you're so focused on just getting through it. And it's really about doing the right thing. And having a short or a small word count is a blessing, and also the devil too, because you want to say a lot of things, but if anything, it helped to keep you like as concise as possible. And if anyone knows me knows that I have lots of words when I should only be using little. And so it was a good practice of being able to say, like, how do you say this thousand word thing in 300 words, because you're only given 300 words. And I still don't know if we actually met that word count, Judy, because I feel like we knew what the word count was, and then we just said, well, we're gonna have to just leave it as is, because there's nothing else that we can take out. So
yeah, we did our best, but and so that's why you end up with an executive summary that's actually published in the print journal. And the full document is now an electronic document only, both with the appendices and kind of recognizing the hazards of guidelines of the past. I will point out, though, structurally, SCCM has really put their money where their mouth is in terms of doing guidelines properly. And this is one big distinction from 2012, where it was a group of volunteers and Nick Bircher took it upon himself to wrangle the software to actually do the meta-analysis. And I'm sure we were heavily influenced by opinion as we actually wrote those guideline statements. And SCCM, we mentioned the budget, it now pays for a librarian, someone to do the systematic review. And we use the guide group out of McMaster's. And so it's kind of that functional arm of the grade group, who are more scholarly and focused on the process. And we had a brilliant methodologist, Kimia Honoramond, who is also an intensivist. And so not only is she good at the methods and, you know, the process, but she lives in that world enough as well. That component and the structure that goes with it really, you know, make all the difference in the world. And moving ahead, SCCM's goal is for a guideline to be completed in 18 months. And that includes the 4 to 6 months of reviews. And so I don't know if that can ever happen, but they've put their line in the sand on that one and given everybody a target.
If you heard me laugh at the beginning of Michael's answer, I wasn't laughing at the advice of having a good experienced person with you. I'm more laughing. It's like, all you need is Judy. You just have a Judy Jacoby, it'll be fine. Everything will be perfect.
Well, when I was working full time, it made a huge difference in terms of how efficient you can be on any one project like this. I never had protected time. And so it would be, you know, well, I'm going to take a day off and work on the project and or on evenings or weekends. And so when you do rely all on volunteers, it's going to take longer. But with a methodologist and the college cracking the whip a little bit, you know, one of my shout outs is for SCCM staff. We now have a guidelines coordinator on staff who helps with a lot of the scheduling and minutes and keeps everyone on track. And so truly, truly, that has made this all a much more professional endeavor.
Yeah, let's get into the shout outs. Anyone that you all kind of want to recognize through this guideline process? I've heard some that might make it, but who's the glue person, the MVP? You know, you shouted out the staff, but let's kind of give some awards here to the other people you were working with.
Well, I definitely would say I'll start with I do think Judy was the glue. Judy, someone obviously who was the lead of the 2012 guidelines. Everyone respects her. It's something that I definitely realized. Obviously, she's respected within the pharmacy world, but I recognize, you know, in this guideline committee that every single individual, every intensivist that was on this panel definitely respected Judy. Judy also was key in making sure that we got through some very contentious pieces of the guidelines, some controversial pieces. There'd be times where, you know, she would send an email and I would leave that email saying that's exactly what I would have wanted to say, but I probably wouldn't have said it that way, because she just has the right kind of touch when it comes to, you know, wording things in a way that gets a point across of like, yeah, we just need to come to a consensus and we need to move on. And she was really good with that throughout the whole process.
And I mentioned Kimia Honoramond and brilliant, and she wrote a lot of the evidence portions of the paper and was so good at helping us through her role as a methodologist. That was why we assigned her as the lead author of the paper. But honestly, Michael is one of the best editors you could ever want to have as somebody who can come back and say, well, you know, is this really how we want to say it, or to give suggestions on a better wording? And again, incredibly responsive throughout the whole process. The one other person I want to mention is Jamie Crinsley, Dr. Crinsley, who is absolutely one of the most passionate people I know about glycemic control, and has accomplished with his own staff amazing patient care and generated data. And for those of us who have been in clinical roles, who are doing good stuff every day, we know how incredibly difficult it is to either generate the data or get the paper written. And he's accomplished both. And he pushed us in a lot of ways to think differently, to expand our view. And, you know, one of the best things you can do on a guideline group is to either have a contrarian or somebody who's really going to push you. And he was absolutely essential in that role.
Okay, so kind of wrapping us up here, narrowing it down to just one each, which may be the hardest question of this whole session here. But what's the take-home point if you had to kind of make one big overarching conclusion for the listeners about glycemic control and these 2024 guidelines looking at it in the critically ill population?
I think for me, obviously, I'm passionate about glucose control. I've been passionate about it since I was a resident. My project as a resident was glucose control related, and I've stayed in that field for many years. I get it that it's not a sexy topic. I get it that, you know, not a lot of people maybe have passion for it. I do think it's still a very important topic, and you know, just like everything else that's cyclical, you know, sepsis is big until it's not, and stress ulcer prophylaxis is big until it's not. I think glucose is still in that phase of, you know, it's still important. We still know that there's work that's needed in the field. CMS has picked up on it and has made, you know, an effort to say that hospitals should be looking and setting metrics for glucose control, even though there hasn't been any like major changes in the literature or publications or guidelines that have come out. They have added that as a new feature this last year. And so I think the one takeaway that I would say for, you know, anybody listening would be that you really need to focus in on your own protocols. And so that's an area that I've spent a lot of time over the past decade, is taking our protocol that we helped design from scratch and then making sure that we do quality projects every few years to make sure that the protocol is meeting our own goals so that you can compare it to the literature. You're only as good as what you know your data is. And I do think a lot of people don't know what their data is. They don't know what their hypoglycemia rates are. They're not looking at hypoglycemia based on, you know, total number of readings or patients or patient days. They're only looking at one type of metric. I think the other piece is looking at compliance to the protocol. I think that a lot of times gets missed, and your protocol is only as good as people are compliant to it. And, you know, even in our protocols, we've looked at it over the time period of looking at it. Even if you're not compliant to the protocol, what are your outcomes when they're not compliant? And if you have a protocol that you're still having good outcomes, even if they're, you know, only 60% compliant to the protocol, then that's a really good protocol that you have, because it gives you a little ebb and flow, and it's not only good if you're following it to a T. So I think that's kind of my big takeaway that I hope people will really look at their own institution and make sure that they're practicing as good quality care when it comes to glycemic control.
Well, I'm going to start at a high level and say, when you see a guideline published or any, you know, really key paper, it's not an academic pursuit. It's really something for you to sit down and say, you know, in my current practice, how much of this are we doing? And you know, maybe there's something that you do differently. You know, nothing is an absolute, but can you justify what you're doing if it is different than what a guideline has suggested? And so Michael has drilled that down to the glycemic control level really beautifully. I think probably the other takeaway is that, you know, little things still matter, and you know, glycemic control isn't the big sexy thing anymore. Michael said, things come and go. It's each clinician doing the little thing right every day that I always have thought is going to make the best outcomes for their patients. And so pharmacists are obviously a huge part of that, but let's take it to the bedside and make sure that our nurses, you know, where the buck stops, everything flows downhill to them. Let's make sure that they have the tools and equipment and protocols that they need to do all those little things right every day, because their list is really long.
I feel like that's a bingo. We got both of them to say big sexy on the episode. So how I feel like that's, someone got a bingo somewhere. But no, in all seriousness, I love that both of those are related to bringing it back to your practice, right? Those two things you all emphasize, that will work no matter where you are, no matter what hospital, health system, et cetera. quality assurance, making sure what you're doing is actually happening and that the people doing it have the resources to successfully do it. So what awesome advice. And even more incredible was everything that you all the knowledge, tips, tricks, and things that you all gave here. Incredibly lucky. Always, Judy, anytime we get to talk to you is an incredible honor. But then obviously I loved having Michael as well, because I think most of us probably are coming from more of that perspective of looking in terms of getting involved with guidelines and things. So I thought a lot of that advice is going to hit home with a lot of people. So Michael, Judy, greatly appreciate both of you. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having us. Been a pleasure being here today.
Yes, absolutely. Our pleasure.
Can't thank Michael and Judy enough. That was incredible. At Judy Jacoby, at MC Ramatros, let them know what you thought. Reference list is in the episode description, as well as the website, as always, pharmacy2dose.com. Reach out to me and let me know what you think, right? At Pharmacy to Dose on the social medias, pharmacytodose@gmail.com via email or via the website, pharmacy2dose.com. And until next time, I'm Nick Peters, and this is Pharmacy to Dose, the Critical Care Podcast. The Critical Care PRN optimizes drug therapy outcomes by promoting excellence and innovation in clinical pharmacy practice, research, and education. For more information, go to critprn.accp.com. Again, that is critprn.accp.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The podcast provides general information only, does not offer individualized medical or professional healthcare services, including pharmaceutical advice. The contents and materials in the podcast are not intended to be a substitute for inpatient pharmaceutical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Use of the contents and materials in the podcast does not constitute a pharmacist-patient relationship. As a result, the information in and materials linked to this podcast are applied at the user or patient own risk. Users and patients should consult their physician or personal healthcare professional. User or patient should not ignore or delay seeking care because of something they heard on this podcast. In case of an emergency, the user or patient should contact their physician, call 911, or go to the nearest medical emergency facility. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are those of the host and guests and should not be interpreted to reflect the official position or policy of ACCP or the Critical Care PRN. ACCP and the Critical Care PRN disclaim any and all liability or responsibility for any direct, indirect, incidental, special, consequential, or any other damages, including without limitation, loss of profits arising out of any use of reference to, reliance on, or inability to use the podcast, its contents, and materials.